Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing globalization of white supremacy and nationalism and right-wing terrorism associated with its rise that mirrors the transnational threat posed by the Islamic State. Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report, joins us from Budapest, Hungary, where there is a conference underway addressing the dangers of transnational white supremacism that is not only reflected in the recent tragedy at the AME Church in Charleston, but is also emerging as a political threat in Europe, where the far-right National Front in France just came in second in parliamentary elections as neo-fascist parties in Hungary and Greece gain ground. Then we'll assess the impact of Tuesday night's speech to the Iranian people by the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, who laid down red lines in the nuclear talks that are facing a June 30th deadline, hardening Iran's stance in a way that appears to undercut a framework deal that was announced in April. Moshe Milani, the Executive Director of the Center for Strategic and Diplomatic Studies and Professor of Politics at the University of South Florida, joins us to discuss whether this is a last-minute deal-breaker or a reiteration of previous red lines. Then finally, with the announcement today of the 13th entrant into the Republican presidential primary race, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, we will look into whether the nation's first Indian-American governor could be an unlucky 13, given his plummeting approval ratings in a state struggling with a $1.6 billion shortfall. Julia O'Donohue, a Louisiana politics reporter based in Baton Rouge for the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com, joins us to discuss whether Bobby Jindal's pandering to the Republican Party on allowing the teaching of creationism and his opposition to same-sex marriage will improve his negligible poll numbers. And joining us now from Budapest is Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Mark, your boss, Morris Dees, along with Richard Cohen, had a recent op-ed in the New York Times, White Supremacists Without Borders, which looks into the growing globalization of white nationalism. And you are in Budapest, where there is a conference underway, and you're representing the Southern Poverty Law Center, along with a lot of activists from the United States and Europe, at this conference in Budapest. And of course, Budapest in Hungary's led by Viktor Orban, who's a very authoritarian figure, and it has an extremely right-wing party called Jobbik. So tell us about the meeting and what the agenda is and what your sense is of this growing transnational threat of white nationalism and white supremacism.
Well, it's been an important meeting. We have held these conferences, these annual conferences on the growing internationalization of the white supremacist movement, the white nationalist movement, for 12 years now. Hungary is in a very bad place. The party you mentioned, Jobbik, is essentially a neo-fascist party. Viktor Orban, the prime minister, is not a fascist, and he is not a Jobbik member. But the country is in the grips of a very far-right movement. Just to give you a sense of that, Orban recently said that, by God, you know, his country opposed multiculturalism. People could visit his country, but they sure as hell could not come here and expect to have jobs and that kind of thing. This afternoon, I saw a monument that was put up by Viktor Orban and his party to the Hungarian victims of the German occupation. It portrays Hungary as being raped by the Nazis and so on. Of course, the reality is that the Hungarians passed the very first anti-Semitic laws in Europe in 1920. The Hungarian Arrow Cross organization, a fascist organization, engaged in the murder of 10,000 Jews, shot them and threw their bodies, naked bodies, into the Danube, and so on. And so this monument tries to say that there were no Hungarian fascists, that it was all the Nazis, it was done to the Hungarians. So to get more to the meat of your question, This is a movement that is sweeping the Western world. It is, I think, very much a function of the increased movement of populations around the world, from country to country, for work as the economics move people around. What is happening in the United States, of course, is that we are becoming a country which, within the next 30 years, will lose its white majority. We will be the first country in the world to have gone from a country essentially run by one group, white people, to a country in which no group predominates, which really is a kind of genuine multiracial democracy. But it's been a very tough row to hoe, and the Charleston events show that very clearly. That very same thing is happening in European countries as well. There's a substantial, very far right, in some cases neo-Nazi right, in countries like Hungary, like Britain, like Belgium, like Northern Italy, Austria, even Scandinavia has a serious movement, because the same thing is happening all over. About 10 years ago, I was in Sweden for a conference. And Sweden is a country that I think many of us think of as kind of quintessentially white, you know, sort of very blonde and pale skinned and all of that. Well, you know, today, some 9% of Swedes, of Swedish citizens, are not white. So there's a lot of immigration, a lot of movement for economic reasons, and there is a huge reaction unfolding. So I presume that this too shall ultimately pass, and that one day the world will be in a better place. But we have a very tough row to hoe, and I think that things are very likely to get worse before they get better.
And again, we're speaking with Mark Potok, who is in Budapest, Hungary. He is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Report and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights. So the conference that you're attending, which is about the transnational white supremacism movement that's emerging throughout the world and growing more connected by technology, which we've seen how much the internet influenced Dylann Roof, the shooter at the AME church. He was particularly influenced by the Council of Conservative Citizens, and apparently his newfound racism was relatively recent, but of course it turned out to be incredibly lethal. In terms of the European countries, where you, of course, being there in Hungary, I imagine there are representatives at the conference from France, which to me is very much a tinderbox. Marine Le Pen, the head of the National Front Party, which her father founded, they came in second in the recent elections. There's an explosive mix of a very unhappy Muslim diaspora, I think about 7 or 8 million now, and you've got clashes between Arabs and Jews, or people from Arabic countries, and particularly North Africa, and French Jews are almost at war with each other. Jews are migrating to Israel, encouraged by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And we saw what happened recently with Charlie Hebdo, but it seems as though nothing is being damped down there. If anything, there's a trajectory towards more violence, as far as I can tell, with the rise of Le Pen.
Yeah, I think that's true. And as a matter of fact, just in the last few days, Marine Le Pen was able to form a major group in the European Parliament, a group of right-wing parties from seven or more different countries. And because she reached a certain threshold of a certain number of deputies, I believe it was 35 euro deputies plus at least seven countries, that means that this very far-right coalition will be funded to the tune of 17.5 million euros a year. So the Europeans are now, much against their will, having to actually foot the bill for the kind of transnationalization of this movement, at least at the level of the European Parliament. So, yeah, things are very bad. I am staying in an apartment in Budapest, which is owned by a woman who is married to a Jewish man. They have just recently, in the last few weeks, made the decision to move from Hungary to, of all places, Bonn in Germany, where they feel they will be much safer from violence. And to be fair, there really hasn't been much anti-Semitic violence in Hungary, but it feels very much like it is looming.
Well, there's been there's been anti-Roma violence encouraged by both Jobbik and Viktor Orban.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, in this country, the Roma have it considerably worse, at least thus far, than the Jewish population. But, you know, it's undeniable that things are getting worse. You know, the other point I would make is that there is a substantial role being played by American white supremacists, American white nationalists. Last year, there was a major meeting of white nationalists here. They were ultimately arrested and thrown out of the country because even for Orban, they were an embarrassment. But that involved people like Jared Taylor, the leader of an American group called American Renaissance, another man named Richard Spencer, with a group called National Policy Institute. So we're seeing an awful lot of this. When Anders Breivik murdered 77 people in Norway some years ago because he thought that they were enabling Muslim immigration, he released a huge manifesto, as I remember, some 24,000 words, in which he paid tribute repeatedly to people like Pam Geller, the anti-Islamic group, the American Freedom Defense Initiative. So the Americans play quite an important role in all of this, and that is increased substantially because our First Amendment allows the websites that spread this kind of propaganda to reside on American servers. Much of the propaganda that comes out of the radical right in the United States would be illegal under the laws of most European countries. So these groups like Jobbik and other neo-Nazi formations tend to site their servers in the United States, put their websites on servers in the United States in order to get around this law.
So what do you make of the fact that Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, has, through Russian banks, has helped finance Marine Le Pen's National Front Party? He's also very close to Viktor Orban. What do you think Putin's agenda is in funding European, West European right-wing parties and East European right-wing parties?
Well, I think to some extent what Putin wants is to divide and weaken Western countries. I just saw a story today about Putin or the Russians essentially helping to fund secessionist groups in Texas, radical groups tied to the militia movement. You know, the other piece of it is that white nationalists, both here in Europe and in the United States, see Russia now as their great friend, and more than their friend. They see it as a wonderful country to be admired. I mean, it really is remarkable that the far right, which for most of all of our lives despised Russia, because, of course, that was the home of the Soviets, of communism and so on, now laud Russia as, you know, great white mother Russia. It is seen as an example of the kind of country that they long for, a country that's dominated by white people, that is essentially monocultural, and that is basically an authoritarian society.
That persecutes homosexuals.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, what the Russians do to gay people is really quite incredible. You know, a few years ago, I remember there was a kind of gay pride march in Moscow, attended by, among other people, some Euro MPs, some members of the European Parliament, which was attacked, in fact, by the police force in Moscow, attacked with batons and pipes and so on. So, yeah, I mean, gay people, homosexual men in particular, are very much another target of Putin, and that wins him admiration in certain quarters in our own societies.
So what do you make, Mark Potok, of the moves on the part of Governor Haley and the two U.S. senators from South Carolina to urge the legislature in South Carolina to take down the rebel flag, the Confederate flag? And this has spread to Alabama, where the governor today asked for its removal. It's also a part of the flag of Mississippi. I'm not sure how they will do that and whether they will get rid of their state flag. Well, go ahead.
Well, I think it's remarkable. I think it is a very much overdue thing. But let me say that as far as the politicians, the Nikki Haley's and the Lindsey Graham's of the world, you know, to me it looks completely opportunistic. It's hard to resist the movement. I mean, Nikki Haley has never said one word about removing the Confederate battle flag from the grounds of the South Carolina Capitol until now. Lindsey Graham was obviously opposed to it, but they've taken, you know, such a beating, you know, that they feel they have to do this. You know, it's really, in a sense, the Walmarts and the Amazons of the world that are driving this. You know, businesses have apparently a substantially more rational approach to the world and have realized they just cannot stick with this anymore. So, you know, in effect, Walmart led the way and Nikki Haley kind of followed along. So, you know, I'm very glad that this seems to be what it's coming to. I think the Confederate battle flag is not long for this world, or at least not in the same prominent way that it has been. But, you know, these are decisions that were obvious and should have been made 10, 20, 30 years ago. So, you know, as I say, I'm glad to see conservative politicians joining in on this movement, but it's a day late and a dollar short, that's for sure.
Well, of course, conservative politicians, four of them running for the United States presidency as Republican presidential candidates, Senator Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, Rand Paul, and Governor Scott Walker, have all turned back the money that they got from the Council of Conservative Citizens. At the time, they took the money, but after the shooting at the AME church, they were embarrassed to have to turn.
Yes, and let's remember that even on the national political scene, what the Council of Conservative Citizens is has been very well known for many, many, many years. So the idea that they're so terribly shocked now to find out the racist nature of this group is utter hogwash. The truth is that in 1998, the head of the Republican National Committee urged Republicans all over the country to have nothing to do with what he described as a racist group, which it certainly is. The reason that the RNC had made that statement was that Trent Lott, then the Senate Majority Leader, had been found to have given five different speeches to the Council of Conservative Citizens, in one of which he described the people in this room as representing everything that's right and true and good about America. So, you know, in the result of that scandal, in the wake of that scandal, Lott did not lose his position, which he most certainly should have. But the RNC did make the statement. So the point I'm making is that the claim on the part of these politicians that they had no idea what the CFCC is, and they're so terribly shocked now to realize that the group is openly white supremacist, is thin, to say the least.
Well, just in closing, Mark Potok, the Republicans, of course, inherited the Dixiecrat South from the Democrats under Nixon's Southern strategy and have largely become a Southern party. And, of course, Ronald Reagan, when he announced he was running for president, he did so in Mississippi in a way that was a real signal to the white racist constituency that you found a new home. And I'm wondering whether that is going to be smoked out by this incident, because I think the Republicans are getting a free ride here, given that in the last election, so many of the senators that won in the South for the GOP basically ran against Obama, not against their white opponents, in dog whistle racist terms, which anybody who wants to look at the commercials will certainly agree. And, you know, there is this constant sort of these coded messages going on all the time. And of course, one doesn't have to look further than the way that President Obama has been treated by the Republicans, and particularly by the Tea Party wing, which is very solid in the South, in ways that go beyond disrespect and can only be considered to be racist. So I'm just wondering whether we're capable in our binary news system, where if you criticize the Democrats, you have to criticize the Republicans equally, whether we can have an honest debate about the extent to which the Republicans have engaged in these coded dog whistle racist politics.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say that I think that what you've said is 100% true. I think that's absolutely so. I mean, my reaction to what you said in part, though, is to say it is very difficult to see where the Republican Party is going to go. I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything new when I say the base of the Republican Party is shrinking and shrinking rather rapidly. The fact that we have people like Lindsey Graham now saying the Confederate battle flag ought to come down shows you how small their constituency really has become. Who are they going to appeal to now? I think that you're right that these politicians regularly engage in these coded racial politics, these appeals to essentially racists, white anti-black racists. And as a result, perhaps, of the tragedy in Charleston, they will find it much more difficult to do so. So, you know, there's been an awful lot of talk about the Republicans broadening their base and so on. But, you know, the fact that they are now all of a sudden this week, but not last week, in favor of taking down the Confederate battle flag, I think only tells you how boxed in they're getting. You know, I imagine that they will be successful on some level for a few more elections, particularly in the South, particularly within states as opposed to nationally. But they're going to have to change in some way or they're going to die. The country is simply changing too much, too rapidly for them to survive, it seems to me. Perhaps I'm being overly hopeful by continuing on in the same vein.
Well, Mark Potok, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, who is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether Iran's supreme leader has just tried to scuttle the nuclear talks.
Tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to fight. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Moshe Milani, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Strategic and Diplomatic Studies and a Professor of Politics at the University of South Florida. Professor Milani has served as a fellow at Oxford University, Harvard University, and Foscari University in Italy, and is the author of The Making of Iran's Islamic Revolution. And his recent publications include Iran's Strategy in the Syrian Civil War and What If at First Rouhani Doesn't Succeed, and Rouhani's Foreign Policy in Foreign Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Moshe Milani.
Thank you for having me.
And in a speech on Tuesday night, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, insisted that Iran would only dismantle its nuclear infrastructure if the sanctions were lifted first. He also ruled out a freeze on nuclear research and development for 10 years and ruled out possibility of inspections at military sites. So all of what he's just announced appear to completely undercut what was previously agreed upon in the framework deal announced back in April. So is the Supreme Leader trying to kill the deal?
I don't think the Supreme Leader is trying to torpedo the deal or kill the deal. He has consistently indicated in the past year or so that all sanctions must be lifted exactly when Iran's nuclear program is halted, and his insistence that the West must remove all sanctions, therefore, is not something new. That said, however, it is very clear to me that both the United States and Iran are trying to pressure each other to get maximum concession from one another. It is very clear to me also that people who know what is going on in these negotiations, people who are intimately involved in these negotiations, usually do not talk much. But the people who do not know the details are the ones who talk too much. I would say we need to be a little bit careful about drawing any conclusions about Iran or the West or any of the negotiating partners trying to sabotage the deal. The two sides have made tremendous progress in the past year and a half, and I think it would be in the advantage of both sides to come out with a win-win situation. However, as President Obama is facing serious opposition from the Republicans in this country and from a few Democrats, Ayatollah Khamenei is also under tremendous pressure in Iran by the hardliners who believe that Iran has already given too many concessions to the West, and Iran should not, under any circumstances, agree to inspection of its military installations. They have argued that if Iran agrees with the inspection of its military sites, or if Iran agrees to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to conduct interviews with Iran's nuclear scientists, that would be a loss of Iranian sovereignty. Therefore, they're pressuring the Supreme Leader as well as the Iranian negotiators not to give up and not to allow the West to have complete access to Iranian nuclear to the Iranian military installations.
So, Moshe Milani, these new red lines that the Supreme Leader laid out in a speech to the nation on Tuesday night on Iranian television, how can you then work out a compromise with the U.S. demands that have, and the P5 plus one as well, that have proposed a phased withdrawal of sanctions dependent upon international inspectors verifying Iran's compliance with its pledges to convert uranium enrichment facilities, dismantle centrifuges to enrich uranium, and reduce the stockpiles of enriched uranium?
I think it's going to be very difficult. That's why these negotiations have been extended a number of times. But I'm pretty sure if the two sides are determined to reach a final agreement, they can find an honorable way in which sanctions are lifted and that Iranians' nuclear facilities are inspected. I must say that as far as I know, inspections of Iranian military installations was not part of the original agreement. The original agreement, as far as I remember, was based on inspections of nuclear facilities or those facilities that are suspected of being involved in nuclear facilities, in nuclear program. And this new demand that the West should have access to Iran's military installation anytime they want, I think is something that was added to the negotiations. And the fear that Iran has is that behind this insistence on inspection of military installations or military sites is an attempt by the West to find out more about Iran's missile technologies. Now, remember, Iran is not a nuclear power. Iran does not have nuclear bombs. There is universal consensus about that. But there is also universal consensus that Iranian missile technology is rather advanced. And by agreeing to allow the West to inspect Iranian military installations, many in Iran fear that would undermine Iranian independence and Iranian sovereignty.
And again, I'm speaking with Moshe Milani, who's Executive Director of the Center for Strategic and Diplomatic Studies and Professor of Politics at the University of South Florida. Professor Milani has served as a fellow at Harvard University, Oxford University, and Foscari University in Italy, and is the author of The Making of Iran's Islamic Revolution. And his recent publications include Iran's Strategy in the Syrian Civil War and What If at First Rouhani Doesn't Succeed, and Rouhani's Foreign Policy in Foreign Affairs. So the inspection of the military sites, as you just point out, the Iranians suspect that there's a hidden agenda on the part of the West to find out about its missile program. My understanding is that they also wanted to find out about what exactly Iran has in terms of nuclear designs, etc., because there's always been an assumption that AQ Khan sold Iran a design for a Chinese weapon that has been tested by the Pakistanis. So you're saying that's a kind of new fishing expedition, and that's a red line, obviously, that the Iranians are not going to agree to.
No, the part about the past activities,
right,
or what they usually refer to as the military dimensions of the Iranian nuclear program, that is a legitimate concern. And it has been part of the initial negotiations. And I'm pretty sure the two sides can find a way in which Iran can address the concerns the West has had. That at one time, Iran was developing things that could be that could have been used to build the bomb. That is legitimate. What I'm saying is a little bit different. That issue has to be addressed. And the Secretary of State, Kerry, is on record for saying that all the answers to the questions we have about the military dimension of Iranian nuclear program do not have to be addressed at this time. We can have the deal and then one by one go over these questions. And I think that is a very reasonable compromise. That is different than the demand that the West can have access to any place it wants in Iran at any time it decides to do the inspections. These are two separate issues. One of them, I think, is legitimate, and we can find a compromise, an honorable compromise. The other one, I think, is a little bit more difficult and could create serious obstacles. But at the end of the day, I am today as optimistic about a final nuclear agreement as I was a year and a half ago. And I hope that soon the two sides can reach an agreement which is based on win-win for everybody. I think these sanctions are hurting Iran, and I think the West has a golden opportunity right now to settle a dispute with Iran and end almost four decades of mutual animosity and hostility at a time when the entire Middle East is going through tumultuous transition. We need to have a better relationship with perhaps one of the most important countries in the Middle East, that is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
And what's your understanding about how much money will be sprung loose if this agreement is signed? I understand if you go back to 1979, there's money that's been frozen since 1979. I believe there's something like $150 billion that could be immediately injected into Iran's economy. Of course, getting rid of the sanctions will help enormously, but that won't happen immediately. But whereas $150 billion in influx of cash will have an immediate effect. And a lot of analysts in the West are complaining to Obama, and of course he's getting a lot of heat from the political right, from supporters of Israel, from the Saudi Arabians, and from the Republicans in the Senate and House, that if you give Iran $150 billion, they're going to spend it on sending arms to Syria, to the Assad regime. So how do you answer those questions?
Well, first of all, the money, the frozen money, is not about the 1979 revolution. President Carter did freeze Iranian assets, but then the two sides, once the two sides agreed in Algiers, and signed the so-called hostage release agreement, some of that frozen money was released. and the rest of it was negotiated. What we're talking about is the money that has been frozen in the recent years. There are a number of different estimates, somewhere between $90 billion to $120, $130 billion of frozen assets. I've never heard anybody say it's about 150, but it could be. I do not know. But from what I know, it's about roughly about $100 to $120 billion. And by the way, one misunderstanding is that people think in some television channel, I've heard people say, we are giving Iran $100 billion. No. You're not giving Iran anything. This is Iranian money to begin with. It was frozen. And what Iran does with it, I think, is the business for the Islamic Republic to decide, not for the party of 5+1 or for any other country. This is legitimate money that Iran had earned. They put it in various institutions. Then because of the UN resolutions and U.S. decisions, some of this were frozen. Now, if there is an agreement, would this money be used by Iran to solidify its position? I'm pretty sure they're going to use some of that. First of all, I'm not very sure if they're going to be able or they would want to use all of $150 billion at one time. The Iranian economy simply cannot absorb that kind of infusion at once. They're probably going to use a little bit of it. But their primary concern is going to be rebuilding the shattered Iranian economy. Rouhani was elected as president in Iran because he promised to put an end to these sanctions and improve the economic conditions. Moreover, I believe that the Rouhani administration is the most moderate government we can get in Iran. And therefore, I would prefer to see this money being released when a moderate president is in power rather than a hardline president like Ahmadinejad is in power. And don't forget, there are other countries that are contributing to instability in the Persian Gulf that are providing huge financial benefits to the terrorist organizations. And these countries are also making billions of dollars. So eventually, these monies are released, I think it's going to improve the Iranian economy. And it is very likely that Iran is going to use some of it to solidify its position in the Middle East.
Well, in general, what you're telling us, Mohsen Milani, is that the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is not trying to sabotage the deal. He's not trying to throw a last-minute spanner in the works, as they say. But there have been reports, I don't know whether you read the article by Dr. Trita Parsi and by Paul Pillar, the former National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East. They were suggesting that there could be a war between Israel and Hezbollah in the summer, which would, the collateral damage from that war would be that if, as predicted, if there was a military engagement between Israelis and Hezbollah on the Lebanese border, that Hezbollah would rain rockets down on Israel and that the optics of that would be such that many of the Democratic senators who support Obama at this point, some of whom have been under pressure from AIPAC, the Israel lobby, and from the Republicans and from Prime Minister Netanyahu, would buckle, and therefore the deal would be sabotaged by the U.S. Senate. So given that these kind of reports are out there in the press, do you think the Iranians are aware of these? Would that in any way make them wonder at the end of the day whether these negotiations are futile?
I think Ayatollah Khamenei is well aware of these obstacles. He is also well aware of the obstacles inside Iran. That is really a very strong opposition by the conservatives in Iran to give any concessions to the United States or to the West about Iran's nuclear program. But at the end of the day, I think the two sides, Iran and the United States, we really have no option but to find a peaceful and diplomatic solution to this. Yes, there are countries and there are forces, regional powers, some forces inside Iran, some forces in the United States, that do not want to see the end of three and a half decades of hostility between Iran and the United States. Their strategic advantage is to keep Iran isolated, is to keep Iran an enemy of the United States and the U.S. as the enemy of Iran. But I believe today we have leadership in Tehran and in Washington that want to put an end to this. And if I were to bet, I would say that the two sides can handle these possible problems and hopefully to have a deal which is going to be good for the West, which is going to be good for Iran, and I believe would be good even for the region as a whole.
Well, Moshe Milani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Moshe Milani, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Strategic and Diplomatic Studies and Professor of Politics at the University of South Florida. Professor Milani has served as a fellow at Oxford University, Harvard University, Foscari University in Italy, and is the author of The Making of Iran's Islamic Revolution. And his recent publications include Iran's Strategy in the Syrian Civil War and What If at First Rouhani Doesn't Succeed and Rouhani's Foreign Policy in Foreign Affairs. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the 13th entrant into the Republican presidential primary race, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana.
For the hotel queens and the magazines, test tube jeans and slot machines, where even Richard Nixon has got soul. Even Richard
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julia O'Donohue, a Louisiana politics reporter based in Baton Rouge for The Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia O'Donohue.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you've been covering the entry today of the 13th Republican hopeful for the presidency, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana. So give me a sense. He did a videotape introduction of himself prior to that, and then in a hall in a New Orleans suburb, he made his official announcement, which you covered. So give me a sense of what happened there today.
Well, what happened here today has been a long time coming. The governor has been running, Governor Jindal's been running, if you believe some people, for years for the presidency, maybe as long as 8 years. So it wasn't necessarily a surprise, the announcement. What happened was he gave a pretty provocative speech to the crowd. He is clearly going after a very conservative voter. He's targeting people who are probably identified as evangelical and conservative Christians. He talked about some things that have gotten him a lot of attention, but not necessarily always positive attention. So, for example, he brought up radical Islam again. A few months ago, he got in kind of a lot of hot water for being in Europe, specifically in London, and talking about quote-unquote no-go zones where Sharia law ruled and, the secular, UK law was not enforced. And a lot of the things he was saying were kind of debunked. Nevertheless, he kind of went back to that well in this speech. He talked a lot about, like, religious liberty. He talked about cutting government dramatically. And he talked about, you know, those were kind of the big points he hit on. But it was definitely aimed at getting some attention, you know, saying provocative things.
Sure. But do you think that Bobby Jindal's aware of how much the religious right vote is already under assault, if you will, from Governor Huckabee, from Ted Cruz? It's almost like he's got to line up for that vote.
Yeah.
Is he aware of that, and also aware that in a recent telephone survey, Republican primary voters, Bobby Jindal got 0% as their top pick to be the nominee, compared with Jeb Bush, who earned 22%.
Yeah, so we've mentioned that before, the press corps here. And this morning, his political advisors met with reporters in a frank conversation, and that was brought up. And their explanation, and the governor's explanation when you ask him about it, is that he thinks it's very early and that he's not going to be discouraged by polls because we're so far out from when people are making decisions that he has some time to make an impact. His political team will also say, well, he hasn't been a candidate as long as some of these other people. He just became a candidate, so people don't necessarily know him. And they showed us some polling information this morning. I think it's internal polling to them. I don't think it's, you know, an independent poll. Nevertheless, it shows that people aren't really familiar with who he is. And I guess their point is they feel like he's going to pick up some support when people get to know him. With regards to Governor, Huckabee and Rick Santorum and some of the other people that are going after that base, I guess what I would say is the governor's chief political advisor is a guy by the name of Timmy Teeple, who works in Louisiana and Washington, D.C. And he is a member of kind of the conservative Christian movement and community, and he very much understands that community. So I think, you know, I know that they're probably well aware that they've got some competition. I assume that Timmy feels confident that he's going to be able to make inroads there for the governor. And, you know, the governor threw on LSU's campus a big evangelical non-denominational prayer rally back in January with like a few thousand people, where he told his personal story about conversion to Christianity. He converted when he was a kid from Hinduism to Christianity, which appeals to conservative Christian voters, apparently. So, you know, when you ask them about it, they say it's early and it's wide open. And he mentions the fact that the first time he ran for governor, he was also polling at 0%, and he ended up finishing, you know, being one of the two main candidates. So I think because he's probably been in this position before, he's a little bit unflappable when it comes to that.
And again, I'm speaking with Julie O'Donoghue, a Louisiana politics reporter based in Baton Rouge for The Times, Picayune, and NOLA.com. And we're talking about the entrance today into the crowded presidential field by Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, making him the 13th entrant. Whether he's unlucky 13, we will see. But Julie was just saying that he's been running for president, at least the appearances, he's been running for president for some time. And surely that doesn't sit well with the Louisiana voters, who are concerned about the $1.6 billion budget shortfall. and if he has been pandering to the religious right, as he clearly did with an executive order to protect those who don't support the same-sex marriage act that Louisiana legislature effectively killed, then, of course, he through the Louisiana Science Education Act, he basically allowed creationism to be taught in public schools. Are these perceived by the Louisiana voters as something to do with his presidential race and pandering to Republican primary voters as opposed to doing the work at home?
Yes. And I think we have to be careful to say, you know, Louisiana voters are conservative and they are culturally conservative. We still, in polls here, don't have, I know that the national polling shows that more than 50% of people support same-sex marriage. That's not true in Louisiana. We're not there yet. When you poll the state, still a majority of people are opposed to legalizing same-sex marriage. So I want to be careful about some of that stuff. Nevertheless, I think that there is a sense among the public that the governor does a lot of things because he wants to appeal to someone in Iowa or New Hampshire and not necessarily to the people of Louisiana. And that's across a lot of fronts. I would say the executive order on same-sex marriage, one of the things that really got at least state lawmakers upset, regardless of where they stand on that issue, is that, you know, what happened in Indiana earlier this year when their legislature passed a law like that was that a bunch of people said they were no longer going to bring their conventions to Indiana, their sporting events, you know, their tourist dollars. Well, that's a problem for Indiana, but if people start pulling their conventions out and the NCAA doesn't want to hold events in Louisiana, that's a huge problem. Louisiana is very reliant, particularly New Orleans, on tourism and conventions and people feeling like this is a good place to be and a welcoming place. So I think there were a lot of people who were very upset with the governor for pushing this issue because they felt like the optics around it were going to be very bad for the state and potentially economically damaging, and that it was kind of unnecessary. I heard that from legislators who had voted to ban same-sex marriage in the state, you know, that they were not interested in having an executive order put in place or passing another law. Like, they just didn't want to go there. And then there are a lot of issues with finances in Louisiana. The state budget has had a tremendous shortfall. The governor implemented a tremendous tax cut when he was first in office, and the state is having problems covering its costs, and that's been an ongoing issue. And the governor, in order to keep a no-tax pledge he made to Americans for Tax Reform, kind of put some more restrictions on what he would allow them to do in terms of raising taxes this year, which frustrated some of the public and the state legislators, because the consequences were pretty dramatic cuts to higher education and to public universities, and he seemed more interested in the pledge that he has to an outside group, by some people's estimations, than to what people in Louisiana wanted. So his popularity has fallen off quite a bit in the state.
So, Julia, though, in terms of his evolution as a politician, shall we say, he started out as an Oxford-educated son of Indian immigrants. And as you mentioned, he converted from Hinduism to Catholicism. But he was at 33, he became a congressman. And at the age of 36, he became the youngest governor in the nation. And was considered in those days to be a real policy wonk. So how do you go from being a policy wonk, which is, you know, inherently suggests that, that there's a certain intellectualism involved there, to this sort of anti-intellectualism of creationism and war on science and all of this other stuff that's popular with the Republican right?
Well, I'll add to that just before it's not. I mean, when he was 24 years old, he was tapped by the Louisiana governor at the time to run the State Department of Health and Hospitals as a 24-year-old. So he's always been like a wonder kid. You know, people have always been impressed with him, and he's always been very ambitious. I guess I would say I don't feel like that part of him has gone away. If you talk to him, he is still very much a wonk. He's got a lot of facts at his fingertips. He's incredibly smart. In terms of the other thing that seemed to be maybe not what you would expect of someone called a wonk, I think some of it comes, you know, he is very conservative and religious, and so some of it he comes by naturally. I genuinely think he probably is very opposed to abortion. I genuinely think, you know, he probably has views about same-sex marriage. I don't think that those things are things that he's put on to appeal to a certain group of people.
But what about not believing in evolution?
Well, he was asked that question. He tries to kind of have it both ways. So he says that he teaches his own children evolution, but he thinks people should have the option for that not to be the case, is my understanding of what he said. I think some of that comes from appealing in previous governor's races, appealing to people who find those types of views attractive. He has been successful at getting the conservative Christian community in Louisiana to support him. They strongly back him. And so I think he thinks maybe that is a path to victory. I also, you know, but it's hard to tell where, you know, what, that's a very cynical take on it. I'm sure his political team would say that those are his strongly held, genuine beliefs. But the fact of the matter is he ran for governor once and lost. And one of the reasons he lost is because there were some very conservative people in Louisiana that didn't trust him. And when he started appealing to those groups and going to their churches and talking to them, he won and he became governor. So, you know, there's some proof that when he appeals to that demographic, that he's had success in the past. So,
well, Julia Donahue, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
No problem.
And thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Julia Donahue, who's a Louisiana politics reporter based in Baton Rouge for the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.